You are about to participate in the most ambitious culinary experiment ever imagined.
This competition is going to test everything.
Adapt quickly to anything. I mean anything. The wildest day of your life starts right now.
All new 24 and 24 Last Chef Standing. Sunday night at 8 on Food Network. Stream on Max.
The Vietnam War, it's over.
Your job's just begun.
A new HBO original limited series.
Welcome to the world of spycraft.
Strap in.
From executive producers Park Chan-wook and Robert Downey Jr.
What are you concealing?
Based on the Pulitzer Prize-winning novel by Viet Thanh Nguyen.
What if I told you that I was a communist spy?
How did you become this?
The Sympathizer, streaming April 14th on Max. Subscription required.
Is going on Bar Down Breakdown episode 203. Gosh, that's a mouthful these days. And tonight we're joined by our homie Ken Soucy, a founding member of Unearth and currently just shredding with As I Lay Dying. That must be such a fun track to play. Do you guys still play that live?
Yeah, My Own Grace is one of the staples in the you know, in the set, and it's pretty sick. It's cool too. They're a pyro band, so like when we play like Shaped by Fire or My Own Grave, it's like flames on stage and crap. It's totally dope.
Damn, that just must get everyone going. I'm just like, it's Wednesday night, 8 o'clock. I'm tired as hell, but that just got me going. So
you guys got to be like happy that I'm actually missing the Bruins game for this.
Jeez. Oh, that's fine. Well, they're gonna take the
that's how confident you are.
Yeah. I'll do a podcast. I don't give a shit.
But let me just say that Mikey, who is like the pop punk guy, doesn't get into metalcore, deathcore, hardcore very often. That's a huge compliment coming from him. So I'm glad is. Mikey's joining the darker side of music for a little bit. And I'm really excited that you like that one, Mikey. And normally you're not the guy that will say stuff like that.
Got me going. I'm ready. Let's do this.
Let me tell you a backstory about that particular song real quick. I've been trying to convince the band since I'm the new guy. I'm like, when you go to Europe, right, and you play these like massive concerts, a lot of people like the disco, like the European. They like to go, you know, dance afterwards. You always end up at some random club. I'm like, why don't we just open up the front lobby of this huge venue that we're playing and do a My Own Rave? And change all the As I Lay Dying songs to like rave music and just party with people after the show. They thought it was a cool idea.
Yeah, like that's just straight what 2009 to 2011 Rise Records, just electronic disco in the middle of a breakdown, and then you just go into another breakdown. I'm all for that.
Right.
But Ken, we're super glad that you joined us. Super glad that you're missing the Bruins game, even though you're not really missing much from that. No. I'll probably bite my tongue tomorrow if the Panthers somehow score the upset, but I doubt that's going to happen tonight. No. But next week, if it happens, the three of my Panther fans can shit talk me in the inbox because there's only three of them.
Well, it's okay. I'll probably just miss. Like by the time this is over, Bruins will be up like 6-2. So
yeah, exactly.
Yeah. By the way, I'm all psyched for this too. I don't pull this out often, but I'm wearing my Bruins captain's jersey. I'm gonna let you guys. Are you guys familiar with Bruins like Hall of Famers at all? Like, what jersey do you think I'm wearing?
Oh, I literally just saw the back too, like 5 minutes ago.
It's not Ray Bourque, is it?
Nope. the toughest, I would say the toughest, hands down, Bruin of all time. Toughest guy to ever exist.
Ooh.
I'm not up on my Bruins history. I'm not gonna lie.
24.
Oh, O'Reilly.
Oh, yeah. It's a crowd favorite. He's my favorite. One of my favorite Bruins of all time.
So let's kind of just dive into Bruins talk, since we're already talking about Bruins. So you're from the Massachusetts, New England area. We were talking a little bit before the podcast that you grew up in Danvers, and you know you played for a little bit too. But I always like to just start off by asking, like, how did you get into the Bees?
So my father was a musician, played in a surf rock band, but absolutely loved hockey. And hockey really kind of took off in Massachusetts when we obviously got Bobby Orr. 72, 71, 70, like those years, it really kind of captivated my father. And my brother's 5 years older than me. He played. When I was born, my dad was watching the hockey game. He didn't go into the he did go in the delivery room, but he was watching the game. So that was pretty cool. And he told me the Bruins won that night. So, listen, I've lived on a healthy diet of Bruins my whole life, street hockey with my brother, ice hockey with all of his friends, always playing like with guys 5 years older than me at all times. And all of, like, actually, ironically, all my brother's friends that are my friends that were my brother's friends all had, it was kind of like a weird brotherly thing where like they played, and my brother's friends had little brothers that were my age. So we always grew up playing with each other.
Nice.
So it was like a really awesome kind of like a childhood. You know, we have like, you know, hockey families in my hometown, like the Baldessaris and the Soruses and the, you know, and the Milburys and stuff. And like these guys, you know, we all grew up all together playing hockey constantly.
Now, I'm an Islander fan. We don't like to talk about Mike Milbury.
He's the best. I don't care. He was the best coach ever. He told your owner, the guy who tried to swindle your franchise, to fuck off.
Yeah, but he also then like traded Chara away for nothing and Luongo away for nothing. So that set our franchise back a little bit. Just a little.
Yeah. I used to play soccer against Mike Milbury's kid, and he actually got in a fight on the sideline. So he's a real deal motherfucker for sure. He's awesome.
That out of all the sports to get into a fight over, it's soccer. that is the funniest thing to me, because normally they're just trying to do the play to get the pull a yellow or a red on somebody, but he was just going at it.
He doesn't give a shit. He doesn't give a shit. But yeah, no, I grew up in the Northeast, the North Shore. Hockey was massive in my hometown, Danvers, Massachusetts. I was kind of filling you guys in before, but I mean, we are the town of the Crucible, Session 9, like where the lobotomy was invented at Salem State Hospital. All the stuff that you've read about the Salem witch trials, Rebecca Nurse, Giles Corey, all that stuff happened in my hometown. And there's a dark history in Danvers, but like hockey was always thriving and still is today. As I said, I was lucky enough to play on really, really good teams. None of us played club hockey. We stuck together as kids growing up and played for the town. And our town team was either state champions or close to it every single year. My brother, as I said, was 5 years older than me. His team, when he entered, all I ever wanted to be was a Danvers Falcon. It was like a huge honor in the town to be a captain, which I ended up eventually becoming. My hockey team, my town's hockey team from the years of my brother playing to the time where I graduated, we were 68-0. So we did some damage in the league, and it got a lot of people, a lot of us got scholarships. A lot of us got free schooling because of it. So it was really, really great.
It's funny that you said the stuff from the Crucible too, because I remember in high school I made a giant tombstone like out of like paper mache for Giles Corey. So I had to do like a whole eulogy for him and everything. So it's just funny how like the two worlds kind of like collide. I'm just like, oh yeah, I remember having to like chisel that dude's name into this giant paper mache tombstone that I made, and it was miserable.
Yeah.
But I think actually there's a Olympian Megan Dugan's from Danvers too, I believe.
Megan Duggan. And you Duggan, know what? Yeah. Her brother took the Danvers Falcons as well to a state championship and won too. Brian, fantastic hockey player. You always like look at the kids underneath you and, you know, underclassmen stuff. He wasn't, I was graduated by the time he was the guy, but fantastic hockey player, world-class yeah. athlete, whole family is excellent people. Excellent.
See, I'm just like so jealous hearing you talk about just how relevant and important high school hockey is, because yeah. I grew up in New York. I grew up on Long Island, and you would think being in the Northeast, like everyone just has like really competitive hockey teams, but that's not the case. Like only a handful of teams on Long Island, like schools on Long Island, had their own hockey team, and a lot of towns would combine and have like six or seven towns combined to be on like a hockey team. And yeah. like, I feel like that kind of takes away from like the town pride and being like, yeah, I'm a Deer Park Falcon. And like, it's just crazy to think that, you know, Boston just kind of like across the Long Island Sound has this huge high school hockey culture.
Yeah. Yeah. Youth league, high school, the whole thing. I mean, I'll say this, like my team, I believe was Division One, and it goes by school size. Mm-hmm. But we were good enough to play. Well, they technically put us up divisions like to 1A. We played against like Arlington Catholic and other like really, really top notch teams, and, you know, BC High and all that stuff. So like, even though we were like a D1, like regular school, not 1A, we still played against the big boys. And I think, you know, where like music and hockey kind of like collide in my life is that, you know, the games were not small, especially when you're running on like, you know, like a historical run, like where you're yeah. like 68-0. So when we would play our rivals, I mean, there was Salem State is a big school, hockey school. It has a big arena for hockey. And I would think that like most of our games at least had 2,000 people at it. Most of them. And then like the big games, it was like to the ceiling, these like, you know, rafters, like, you know, people everywhere around the rink, like you couldn't fit another person in these games. And, you know, at the time it's like nerve wracking because you're a kid and you're supposed to, you know, you have fun, but there's a lot of eyes on you at all times. And, the nerves kind of go away after a while. And in my case, like I'm one of those athletes where like, as the game gets more intense or it gets faster, things slow down, yep. In my brain a little bit. So, moving into music years later, when I started playing in front of thousands of people, it actually brought back those memories. I never really get nervous. Actually I was always like a antagonist. So, you know, I liked it when people booed me, you know, and shit like that. So, like even today, to this day, like when I play music, like, if someone has a problem with me, I'm, you know, I don't give a fucking shit. Like, I'm going to do my thing, you know? So, music and hockey for me was like very, very similar. And you know, what's really crazy too, is that like when you're a kid and you grow up and like you know, if you're an outcast and you're not into sports, usually like punk rock kids and shit used to think that like athletes were dickheads, mm-hmm. and like jocks were actually pretty open-minded to guys who like listened to hard rock or heavy metal or were outcasts. They did see them as different, but they were interested in like what they did. So I was always like a cool, like I used to bridge the two together a lot, where I would introduce them to like, hey, this is my buddy. He skateboards and he plays in an awesome metal band. I would go to like random shows and see like Caven and Converge and like all the shit and bring some of my hockey friends there. I mean, there was a big band in Massachusetts called Sand Black Church. A lot of my guys were interested in that shit and we'd play it in the locker room. But like my guys like listen to like AC/DC and Led Zeppelin and like hockey music, you know, but they were down for a little bit of Metallica and like they'd be like, Seuss, man, you know, what's that kill your mother, kill your father shit? You know, that's pretty cool. And, you know, and as I grew up and I became a musician and I started like getting to know other musicians like that were like big and famous, I started realizing that like the big dogs in the music biz were no different than like the big dogs on my teams. You know, if anything, the jock guys were kind of funnier because they're a little more laid back and a little more comical. But yeah. For the most part, the personalities are the same, especially like the tight wound, like musicians who think they're special. Like there are hockey players like that too, who would be like, you know, like prima donnas kind of like that and think they're special too.
Yeah.
But at least in like in music, you can't knock someone down a peg or two by fucking laying into them on in practice or in a game. But yeah, that's why I think hockey players are a little more grounded, because you can fucking really, like, someone gives you shit, you can fucking hand it to them.
Yeah. Put them in the boards.
Yeah. Especially when you're wearing a C on your jersey, you got a, you got an old man, some people sometimes, you know?
So let's, I kind of want to just like segue into just growing up in the Massachusetts area. Cause you just kind of brought up the, you know, going out and seeing Converge. You know, Converge has been a band and has been a huge influence on the heavy metal music scene since the early 90s. But what was it like kind of like seeing them, you know, growing up in Massachusetts as they were kind of like coming up?
Well, it's much different. Like, you have the internet now, right, where you can, yeah, like seek out bands and go find them and see where they play. Back in the day, I was obviously like this jockey kid who would like mingle and like love heavy music. So there was a in North Andover, as Converge and Caven would call it, the Merrimack Valley. They had their own scene, and like, believe it or not, there was like this barn in the middle of nowhere in the sticks that would, I wasn't old enough to drive, and I would have my father would drive me all the time to this place called the Red Barn, and I would see like Overcast and Converge and all these amazing bands like Youth of Today would, you know, show up, and like all these like hardcore bands, Bane and Piebald, and like there's such a weird mix of music coming out of that like one little scene.
Yeah.
And obviously Converge was playing clubs and stuff like that, but I'm talking about like the real early days when Converge was still, they still sounded like Biohazard, you know? So like I was there very, very early, and I was just absorbing all the great music in that area. And it was like, you had to kind of go to the VFW halls and see what was happening. And it's actually how I kind of met Buzz. I went to go see this band called Spoo, and they were like really awesome. This guitar player was like, little kid, he looked like Kurt Cobain, and he was like a virtuoso and played like pretty cool metal. And I saw this band called 0.04, which was Buzz Rover, who passed away, who was in Unearth and the original member, and Mike Rudberg, and a couple other guys. It was just like, they played this like weird battle of the bands, and like I thought they were fucking amazing. And I remember saying to somebody randomly, like, I was like, bands don't play metal like these guys. Like, if I was ever going to be in a band, I would want to be in a band with like these guys. And sure enough, like years later, people would be like, yo, like Buzz hit me up and he's like, yo, I hear you're a good guitar player, you should like come try out. And like, I was like, I was floored. I was like, oh my God, I can't wait to play with this band 0.04. And it's kind of crazy because like, you know, we were playing a certain type of sound of metal that like people weren't, you know, interested in, or like, it was like, you know, the straight edge hardcore thing was really big, and Converge was like, you know, they were pretty extreme, but they kind of like owned Boston for what they did, and it was very hard to get shows. So we just like put our heads down and did our thing. And we actually came to Long Island, New Jersey, and Canada, and all these other places. We got cool elsewhere before we got cool in Boston, really. So it was like kind of one of those weird things, because everyone's always looked at us as like these guys from 0.04, and oh yeah, they're whatever. But when we left town, we started playing everywhere else. We got greeted like very kindly by other scenes, and we got really lucky.
Which is crazy to think too, because like it, especially like within that scene, like you had Killswitch Engage coming out, you had Shadows Fall coming out, like you had all these like integral bands coming out from like with a similar sound, all from like almost like the same area. And it was just, it's always kind of funny when you talk to some of these bands, are like, yeah, like we were big everywhere else, and everywhere else gave us a lot of love, and then our hometown didn't, and then they did.
Dude, Adam D and I, we were like, okay, so this is the weird bridge between Eastern Mass and Western Mass, and I think the guys would admit this if you asked them.
Yeah.
I went to school for 1 year. I got like scholarships to like really great hockey and soccer schools, and like I wasn't sure college was right for me. So I went to a state school where a lot of my friends from high school were going to, so I could play soccer with them. Just guys that I grew up with, and I just felt comfortable my first year of school, like, you know, just going there. And that was in Western Mass, and that was at a place, a school called Westfield State, which is now Westfield University. I happened to just like one night go to a radio like kind of thing, like a late night like pirate radio thing. And there was this kid, his name was Theo, and he was playing like Hatebreed and Bane and all these great bands. And I was like, dude, you're into this music. And I'm like, yeah. And I'm like, it was like December. So like half the year was over. I was like, yo, like, I've been starving for a fucking show. Like, is there, like, anything around here that I should know about? And he's like, well, I play in a band called Catch 13, which was, like, a up-and-coming straight-edge band. Tom Gomes, yeah, who was the original drummer from Killswitch, played in it, and a few other guys. But I met a lot of really great people. And from there, I met Scott Lee. I met Adam D. I met all these guys. And I saw, like, I met Phil Labonte when he was the singer of Shadows Fall. I was seeing all these fucking cool bands from over here. And I started, like, integrating .04 into, yeah, Western Mass. And then we, like, you know, I kind of, like, put the kibosh on .04 and I asked Buzz, like, will you start this other band with me? And the other guys came and we kicked some guys and we shift some members around. We didn't have, yeah, a singer. But ultimately what ended up happening was like, I knew Adam before when he was in Aftershock. I always knew Adam D as, like, him and his brother Toby.
Yeah.
You know, and I used to, like, sleep at Adam's house and we used to go out and, like, hang out at parties and shit. Like, you know, so this is all pre-Killswitch Engage and all that other stuff. So, you know, like, it was a really special time. And, like, even when the bands got big, like, it was always like, oh, it's just, it was always just cool to hang out with your friends. Mm-hmm. But I'll say that, like, the Killswitch Engage show that got them signed, we played this place called a Flywheel. It was a room that was no bigger. It couldn't have fit more than 60 people maximum. And there was, oh, like, maybe like 15 people there and they were all sitting on the floor. Killswitch Engage played in front of Mike Gitter and we played and, like, we sat down on the floor when we played because everybody else was sitting down on the floor. And, like, that was, like, our first show with Killswitch Engage and that shit, you know? So it was like, it wasn't like it was great and glorious, but Killswitch was always great. Adam was,
yeah,
Adam was the producer. He was the guy, you know, like, he was just a good friend, still is to this day. Just a rad dude, you know? We met so many good people. Like, even the Killswitch's tech, Josh, the guy who strings their guitars and puts on the show, I've known him longer than Adam. Like, and he's still there working for those guys. I was there when he met his wife, you know? I was there when I was going to college and hanging out with his friends, you know? Like, it's just, we're talking about 1998, 97, yeah, you know?
That's so sick. I love it.
Yeah.
This is what this podcast is for. Getting these, like, these stories coming out of just, like, what life was like back before we had the internet to promote.
Yeah.
Shows. Like, you know, I remember.
You know, it's funny real quick too. Just to add to this, I'm, you know, think of a young, like, if you look at early pictures of Unearthed, look at, like, Trevor, my singer, like, you know, ran track. He was a jock. I fucking, like, played hockey and other sports. We used to, like, kill time when we, like, showed up to a show playing wiffle ball. When, yeah, we, like when we met up with, like, when we first, like, went on tour at, like, Poison the Well and other places and, like, Stings to Conscience, that record, like, blew up kind of in our scene-ish, and we made it to the West Coast. I'm not going to name names, but we got asked to, like, hang out and sleep over, like, some really cool kid's house, like, you know, from these bands. And these West Coast kids with all their haircuts flipping up and the half dyed and everything was just perfect.
Yeah.
Like their outfits and the girls they were hanging out with and everything. Like they literally took one look at us and they're like, these guys are fucking jocks. Like we weren't cool. And like, and I think like as the band like got cool, they were like still confused as to why we were cool. Cause we weren't like as scenesterish, you know?
Yeah. I think that was kind of like, you know, the, you know, coming, I played sports all throughout high school. I played football. I was on the wrestling team. We didn't have hockey in Florida, like, at all. I literally came from, like, Miami. I grew up going to Poison the Well shows, like, catching them, like, throughout, like, the early 2000s as much as I could because that was when I was able to convince my mom to let me go to these shows. But, you know, one of the reasons why I gravitated more towards, like, at least exactly what you were saying, like the Boston metalcore, deathcore genres is because you guys looked like me and I, yeah, looked like you guys. And I never wore like the deep V cuts or I never had the bleached hair or any of that stuff that's like now kind of like memorized or it's like it's immortalized in like MySpace scene culture. I was the exact opposite. I was, right, the guy in, you know, a hockey snapback hat going to shows with like Adidas Old Schools and like spin kicking some kid in the chest.
Right.
Like that's who I was.
Right.
And I gravitated because of exactly what you said. Like you guys were the, like, you know, you guys dressed up like the jocks, and that's how I gravitated more towards, like, especially just Boston metal in general, or Massachusetts metal in general.
Yeah, well, like, it's funny, my best friend played in a band called Waltham in the area, and Waltham mm-hmm. was like a really good like pop band. You should check them out, they're fantastic. But before I knew these guys, before I knew Frank, before I knew his brother Dave, who are like master musicians, unbelievable artists, we played a show, and Frank tells me to this day, the first time he's like, I heard of you or your band, my brother went to the New England Metal Fest, and he's like, yo, there's a dude on the stage, and like, he's like, he looks like us, he has a big head, little body, playing guitar like he like fucking just got out from under a truck, you know, like you know, doing some mechanic work on a truck, like worked at a radiator shop or some shit, you know, and like he's playing metal like you know, like a dude, and he, I think we're related, that's what he kind of said, and he's like, I gotta see this band, you know. And like, it's funny too, because like, that's the way I try to come off on stage. Like, I'm not trying to like I'm not trying to wear perfect clothes or yeah. like, look metal or be metal. I'm trying to be Ken Susie. Like, if you meet me in real life, like, you're going to get the guy who like, yo, I want to hang. Like, you look at me on stage and you either say, I'm not into that dude because he's fucking gross or whatever. Or you look at him and you say, I'd love to like hang out with this guy because like, yeah. he's like one of my buddies that, you know, he reminds me of this guy that I hung out with or something, you know?
You guys were the dudes shredding on stage, downing beer, and having yeah. a good fucking time. Like, that right. was 100% what drove me into this entire, just any genre that had core after it, I was into it.
Right. Right. Like, literally, like, I'll tell you this. Like, I literally just played hockey the other, like, last night. And, like, the talk, like, I party with my hockey team the same way I party with my metal dudes. And like, I was actually talking the other night. I was like, when Azalea Dying plays fucking the Palladium or Boston, I'm going to get my own dressing room. We're going to get a keg and we're going to have a fucking keg party in it. I'm going to have my whole fucking hockey team in there and all my buddies. And we're just going to get weird for a while and fucking play a show, you know?
Yeah.
Are they like familiar with your band? Like, they're a
couple
aware
dudes.
That you...
A couple dudes I go to shows with. My really good friend Nick, who plays on my line, he's a phenomenal hockey player. He and I, like, you know, he comes to like my shows and I go to his all the time. He's very much into metal. And there's a couple other guys that are like really like, I took them to see Carcass, Obituary, and Amon Amarth. And you know, it's like, there's times where I'm just like, yo, since I work artist relations for Fishman, like, I'm always going to concerts, so I just take my buddies with me. And you know, it's always good rolling with these fucking dudes that are like massive hockey players. These gigs.
So now that you brought that up, I'm just going to ask the question for the gearheads that will listen to this, and they'll be mad at me if I didn't ask this. So how did you get involved with Fishman?
It's really, really a crazy story. I, you know, long story short, I just always knew Fishman was in Boston. Mm-hmm. And Larry Fishman is known as this, like, I think he's just like, if we're going to talk about like the Godfather, he's like a made man in the industry. Like, he's like, you know, he's one of the guys you have to meet in your life. Yeah. Time. He's kind of like a, you know, a urban legend, you know, how great he is. And, so like, they were working on a new pickup company, like, they're the number one like pickup provider for all OEM acoustic guitars, and they're just known for, like, you know, I used to say they're the Les Paul or the Fender of acoustic guitar pickups and stuff.
Yeah.
They're the top of the top, right? But like, my brother, who is a shredding guitar player as well as a hockey player, is a very online active guitar Ibanez forum guy, and he builds guitars and stuff. And this one guy, Frank Falbo, reached out to me and said, Larry Fishman wants to meet your brother from Unearth and blah, blah, blah. And he wants him to come in and try these pickups. Now me, like, I used to get flown around by like EMG and other in my guitar companies, Ibanez and whatever. So I was never really interested in like checking out guitar pickups that, like, you know, cause everyone's really stubborn. It's something you just don't want to change. And like, I went in there as a professional kind of courtesy to just, I just thought it'd be cool to meet Larry Fishman. So I went in there one day and like, he's like, bring all your great guitars. Like, I want you to AB. And like, his pickups were like so good, like leaps and bounds better than anything I had. He had guitars that were like worth like $700-$800 that were blown away $4,000-$5,000 guitars that I had. And I like literally, like, it was like a brand new thing. And I was taking a huge risk by even just thinking about like going there and like becoming an artist for them, because they didn't really have a huge artist roster or anything. And they were trying to like basically court me to play the stuff. And like, I'm looking around the room and I'm like scanning the room as I'm trying these pickups out. And there's guys in like popped collars and polo shirts, and they're like very acoustic oriented company. And like, I left there and I'm like, Larry, like, let me take some of these pickups to my studio and let me try them, and I'll give you a call. And he gave me his personal number. So like, that was like a Friday. And I think I called him on like Monday or Tuesday the next like week. And I just called him and I said, I've been doing a lot of thinking about this. This pickups are really, really good. And I said, I'm a professional musician. And like, I've invested my money wisely. I've done real estate. I've done like a lot of different things. And I said, like, I don't need a job with you, but I have this like eerie suspicion that like, if I join up with you, this isn't going to like, if I don't join up or whatever, if I don't help you with the project, I don't want it to fall flat on its face. I want to see you make money, and I want to see this get out there because the technology is too good. It's the best invention from on a guitar that's happened in the past like 30 years. Mm-hmm. And I said, I want to be a part of this. And he's like, so he had me come in and we did like 3 days of like interviews and shit. And like, I met up with the team and they grilled me for like 3 days. And then at the end of it, they're like, we need to pay you. Like, if you're going to be an employee or you're going to work for us, like, you know, we need to pay you. And I'm like, I don't want any money. I'll do it for free. Like, this is just too good. I like really just want to help you, Larry. Like, this isn't like a money thing for me. And he's like, no, like I need to pay you, you know? So like the final conversation with me and the COO was like, I don't know, pick up managers, like whatever manager makes at McDonald's or whatever, fucking give me whatever they make, you know, I don't give a shit. And like, they hired me. I went in there one day a week. And then by like 3 months later, like Larry, like introduced me to his wife at the Christmas party. And he's like, oh, this is the new Fluence brand manager. And I'm like, what are you talking about? And he just kind of winks at me and he's like, don't worry about it. And like, he's just like, he's just kept me under his wing. And he's like, you know, he believes in my vision, and we've created it. We work really well together, and me and the team and Larry, he's just created such a path for success for me there. He's just such a, like, he's a father figure to me, like, other than my own dad. Like, I respect him. I've learned so much from him. He's one of the greatest people I've ever met. And like, I've met like Dimebag, and I hold him in such high regards. Like, Larry Fishman is right up there with like all the gods I've ever met in my life. And he's genuinely like one of the best people I've ever met, like even out of the business as well.
That's amazing. It blows my mind. Like you said, like, you know, you went in there just thinking they're just an OEM, like acoustic, you know, just a pickup company, and just seeing how the Fluence pickup has influenced heavy music in general over the last 10 years has been absolutely mind blowing.
Yeah. Well, no one knew how good it was. And I've literally like, I spent 3 years on the phone, like being like, hey dude, like seriously, please, I swear, just try it. And it wasn't because I was making money on it or I was selling people on it or anything. It had nothing to do with that. I was literally like, Adam, D, fucking try this, dude. I know this is going to change your life. And when dudes did try it, they were like, Jesus Christ, like, how do I get more of these? And like, as the world turns and every year that goes by, we went from making like nothing to making millions. And like, we're just, the product line is just taken off, and it's for good reason. It's like the foundation of Fluence and the people that surround it are built on everything that's good in the industry. There's no ill will. There's no like dirty business shit that happens behind the scenes. There's no like shitty, like, I can't explain it, but like, you, I think you guys all know, if you work in corporate America, there's always shitty people with their tactics and the things that they try to pull to, like, you know what I mean? Get some, like, get ahead in life. And like, Fishman's not like that. We do straight business. We think about the people that are playing our products, and they just do good business and they do good things. And it's like, we're making the world better by doing it. And we've replaced an 80-year-old technology that's just bullshit. Copper winding pickups. It's like watching an old tube. It's like watching the hockey game on a tube television versus a high def, you know,
TV.
Yeah. It's like, you could see everything. You could see the pimples on someone's ass, you know, like that's how Fluence is. If you play bad, you'll hear it. If you play perfect, it sounds perfect, you know?
I love that.
Mike, you think that's a good segue to get into our DraftKings talk? Just get that out of the way.
All right.
All right. So light the lamp during the hockey playoffs with DraftKings Sportsbook. Right now, new customers can make a $5 bet and score $150 in bonus bets instantly. So
can I endorse it too?
Yeah, absolutely.
You lose all your, or you could just lose all your money and make all the worst picks. Hundreds of dollars down the drain. DraftKings, buy it. Download it now.
Amen.
So, like, put all your money on Crosby to not score.
Well, he's not scoring right now.
Yeah, that's true.
That is a fact. So you will lose a lot of money if you put money on Crosby to score.
Yeah.
How crazy. I know we're in the middle of an ad, but how crazy is that Sidney Crosby's not in the playoffs right now? I think everyone's so happy.
Yeah. He's soft. He's soft. When the Bruins played them, like, I don't know, whatever, when Char was still around, like, I forget, we went to the playoffs and Crosby just got so bent over. He couldn't break Chara. And Char just fucking kept leaning into him all series. It was just such a great thing to watch.
So anyway, DraftKings, Sportsbook app now and use promo code THPN. New customers can make a $5 hockey playoff bet and score $150 in bonus bets instantly. That's code THPN, only at DraftKings Sportsbook. All right. So, Justin,
you ready for Raycon? Let's face it, guys. Yeah. With coffee starting at $5, even without customizations like your cinnamon, vanilla, brown sugar shaken espresso, and our bank account somehow always depleting, we are officially entering a dupe session. Most products do the same thing but are priced differently solely based off of the brand name. So a good duplicate or dupe is crucial for getting the highest quality at the best price. But one dupe that you shouldn't sleep on: Raycon wireless earbuds.
Raycon is premium audio at a perfect price point, so you can listen to what you want, when you want, without breaking the bank. Raycon's mission is to prove that you shouldn't have to pay an arm and a leg for quality sound and essential smart tech listening features. You can get a pair and a spare and still pay less than you would with some of those other more big name tech brands out there. Raycon knows that in this economy, every purchase needs to be perfect. They offer buy now and pay later options. Right now, you can pay as low as $18 at checkout. They have an easy and free return guarantee. They offer 2 years of product protection insurance for just a few bucks. They offer free domestic shipping and flat rate international shipping. And they have over 50,000 five-star reviews.
Sign me up, baby.
So go to buyraycon.com/THPN and get 15% off your Raycon order. That's buyraycon.com/THPN to score 15%. Buyraycon.com/THPN. So, Kent, I want to jump into kind of that like crossroads moment. So, you know, you clearly were very interested in soccer, hockey, and music. At some point, you had to kind of make a decision on kind of where you wanted your life to go. And I guess, was there like one moment that stands out as like, you were like, all right, I'm choosing the path of music?
Yeah, it was a pretty easy decision. I spent most of my life playing hockey and soccer, and it was like, it consumed all of my time, and music was always in and around all that. So I was always busy, always getting shuffled around. By the time I got to college, you know, I played 1 year hockey and soccer at Westfield State. Then I went to UMass Boston, played 2 years soccer, 1 year hockey. I couldn't do 2 years of hockey just because it was like, it was too much, just with like the workload. And like, I was like constantly, especially in the winter months, like on a Friday, like playing, like, you know, my band would be like, we got to go play Philly. And we'd like, they pick me up from, you know, college on Friday, and we'd drive straight to Philly, play a weekend, or go to Canada and then come back. It was just too much. So, honestly, the moment, I knew I wasn't going to like, always wanted to play in the NHL. I always wanted to try to like get up in the OHL and all that. And, you know, I've obviously like jumped into like certain games with guys and certain teams and like, you know, in different leagues. But what ended up happening was like, I did a lot of playing with Chris Pronger, Martin St. Louis when they were like training at BU. I had an in there, and like those guys were just so fast and so powerful. Mike Greer, another great player. They were just so big and strong, and like Martin St. Louis was like my height, but so fucking powerful. And I just knew like, I'm not going to make it, right? Like, it's just like, you just know. But also like, there's a moment too, like where like, you know, your coach is like, I'm not going to name what sport or which coach, but like, you know, you're supposed to give your whole body. You're supposed to sacrifice like everything to like block a shot or save a goal or to score something. And like, you know, when your team's like doing well, but you're not like necessarily in first place, you might be third or whatever. You get to a point where you're like, I don't want to break my hand. I can't break my hand. I can't break my wrist. I can't break another rib. Like, I can't bruise my back again or whatever, you know, or take a shot off the top of the foot. Like, I just remember being on the bench and saying like, this is my last year. Cause like, I got to save myself for the things that are important. And at that time I just knew something was going to happen with Unearth. And it was a huge risk, because back in like 2000, there was no real Ozfest or real Warped Tour for metal bands. Underground metal bands are playing VFW halls, and like metal was not mainstream yet. You know, Killswitch, I think, was just putting out Alive or Just Breathing. So the scene wasn't that fruitful, even though there was some bands that were doing it. And there was never a like we never got in the van thinking like, we're going to make money and be able to support our lives in the house. It was more like, we just got back from a month of touring, and I came home with $1,500. I paid my rent, like, and I have a few dollars extra, you know, like, and then I would pick up like, you know, shitty jobs, like at a temp agency just to get through. I was actually a tax examiner for a while at the state, Mass Department of Revenue. So like I was doing things, and I had a really nice job, and I could have like walked in, making that $90,000 a year. But I actually, like, right out of school, I saved one credit to like, I when I say saved, I didn't, I graduated, I walked, but I didn't get my diploma, and I left one credit open. So I could either play sports when the band was over, or I could just like finish school with a up-to-date diploma. So I told my parents, I was like, 'cause they're a big part of my life. I said, listen, I just graduated college with one credit shy. I said, I really want to just like tour for a couple years and get this out of my system and make sure that like, I can't, like, I'm not missing out on anything. And then after 2 years, I'll come back and I'll like just finish the one credit and have a valid degree and just move on with my life. I just got to see this one through. And they were very supportive of it. They didn't know what the fuck I was doing. They just knew I was going on tour. And then, like, I swear to God, like 2 years later, like, we were on Ozfest. We were out on tour with Dimebag, like the Damage Plan and all that shit.
Yeah.
Hatebreed, and like these massive tours. And my parents had no fucking clue. They had no fucking clue what I was doing, even though they were very supportive. But like, I remember I came home from tour all beaten up from that Damage Plan tour because we were drinking so much with Dimebag. And my mother, like, I was like actually staying with them at one point because I didn't have a home. And my mother just like looked at me and she's like, when are you going to get married? Like, when are you going to like have kids? When are you going to like get a job? And like, you know, this, you can't do this your whole life. And I was like, you have no idea what I just did. Like, you have no idea. Like, I said, like, I think we're going to make it for whatever that means. Like, before, it started off with like, just like trying to drive from place to place and hope that people knew our lyrics. And like, when we played, like, people would sing in the mic with Trevor. And then it turned into like, we're playing fucking Ozfest. And like, and that was the turning point where, like, when we got like offered Ozfest, it was like my parents came out and saw that we were playing with Black Sabbath and Ozzy, and like we were playing massive festivals and with thousands of people. And then they started coming out to the Slipknot shows. My mom, as I called it, started getting recognized at the fucking Stop and Shop downtown in Grafton. Like, she'd pull out her credit card and someone would be like, oh, do you know Ken Susie? Are you related to him? She's like, oh, he's my son. And she'd just brag that, like, you know, people, like, you know, kids that are handling baggage would be like, wait, Ken Susie lives in this town? You know, like, shit like that started happening to them. So then they were starting to be like, wait, like, I think, like, they're doing something. So they were more understanding and, like, obviously very supportive and loving people. And I ended up, like, in 2005 buying the house right next door to them. And my brother lives on, like, you know, my sister lives up the street. I bought the house next to them. My brother lives on the other side of my parents. We own a whole cul-de-sac. So
yeah, if you, like, everybody loves Raymond.
Yeah.
Just real life.
Oh, I love my family, and they're the greatest. They're the greatest people in the world. Like, I grew up in a family where, like, very musical. None of us ever argued. Like, we're just really, like, kind people at heart. They keep me very grounded. But, yeah, if you read, like, if you go on any forum and people talk about me, they're like, Ked Susie lives at home, or he lived at home all these years. I'm like, no, motherfucker, I bought a $500,000 home next to my parents, and I would specifically put my studio in here so I could work here and then go upstairs and eat ravioli with my parents, you know? So like, that was a fucking, like, that was important to me. Yeah. And without them, like, you know, that was the real transition. I kind of gave you like the transition into like real life, but yeah, my family and like everybody started really recognizing what I did when we started hitting somewhat of a mainstream, which was, you know, we were on Headbangers Ball. I was on TV. Like, I just recently played Vok in front of 90,000 people, and fucking, it was like the most surreal moment in my life with like As I Lay Dying, this new band, this new experience. And I sent my parents and my hockey team, like, and everyone I knew, like, because they're all like, Seuss, if you're gonna play this shit, like, send us the link so we could watch it. And so they're watching it, and everyone's like, my nephew lived next door. We're like, is that really my uncle on stage playing in front of all those people? He had like, my nephews don't even fucking know what I do, you know, like, for a living. And it was a really amazing moment because there's like massive amount of people. All my guys got to like see what I do. And my parents were definitely like, it was funny. I called my father like right after the show, cause it was like, you know, pyro and shit at the end. And I was calling him, but I didn't know there was a delay. So he's like, cancel the phone. He's like, hey, what's up? And I'm like, hey, did you like the show? And he's like, Ken, is that you? I'm still watching you. Wait, how are you on stage? He's like an older guy. So anyway, it was fucking awesome. Like, you know, I've lived such a great life, you know?
It's just so funny. Your mom sounds like my mom. Like, she saw you at Ozfest playing to all these people. But the moment she realized that you made it was when your name was recognized in Stop and Shop. Like, my mom's whole life revolves around the grocery store. She'd be like, oh, Michael, did you hear that? Like you can get your loans forgiven by going to the hits. And I'm like, where'd you hear that? Oh, I was talking to someone in Stop and Shop. I'm like, what the heck? Like, who do you talk to?
Yeah. I mean, when you're an older woman and you go to Stop and Shop and someone's like, hey, Susie, huh? Or like one time, ex-girlfriend of mine from middle school, like literally like, hit my mom up and she's like, hey, Mrs. Susie. She recognized her from like years ago. And then she's just like, your son's the only rock star I've ever dated. I just want to let you know. My mom's like, okay, I don't even know who the fuck you are, but that's cool. It's so funny, but no, it's been a wild ride and I've given them a lot to be proud of. You know, I try to like, I know that like Mike, I call it a character I play on stage, but I also played in real life. Like, that is me. Like, the wild side of me is all the guy who's on stage and backstage. But for the most part, like, I've done my family right. I've done my family. Like, my family's very close, even my extended family. So they all respect what I do. And I try to do my best, you know, to like, you know, have people know my family name and have a positive, I guess, like, you know, like
interaction,
remembrance. Yeah. Of what that is, you know?
Cool. So, one of our favorite things to also talk about on this podcast is when your two worlds collide. So like, you've played all over the world and clearly you're a huge hockey fan. So like, when you're on tour and playing in some of these arenas and stuff, like, have your two worlds like literally meshed ever when you're on the road?
Yeah, a lot. I was really good friends with a guy who ran the Pepsi Center in Colorado, and he used to feed me equipment like a lot. So, and sometimes ice time when I was up there, you know, so that was like always really great. Cause like, you know, before a concert, I wouldn't be backstage getting ready. I'd be fucking in an arena fucking by myself, ripping slappers, you know, shit, that's, you know, sick. which is dope. And then like, I think Mitzi probably talked about this, who's like one of my favorite guys in the whole planet. Like, touring with him's always been great. Cause he and I just like, we'll yell at each other in each other's faces about how I think the Rangers suck, you know, and fuck you, fuck you, the Bruins, you know, like we get like, I wouldn't want to fight him because his fist is probably as big as my head, but we've almost come to blows over hockey conversation, but I love him to death. And one time we got to, we played I forget what tour we were on.
Was it Sounds of the Underground?
Maybe, yeah. And we went into the Edmonton Oilers locker room.
Yes, I love this story.
Yeah, and like, you know, he and I were just basically like, you know, we got the tour, and then they're like, oh, we got to show you the door. And like, obviously, you know, just I know you guys have probably heard this, but like Mark Messier during the playoffs, like fucking punched a hole through a steel door that like, we all know what that hockey door looks like from, you know, whatever. And to punch through that fucking thing, even Mitz and I were like, God damn it. Like if there was ever a time, if we were in that locker room and some motherfucker did that, I would be ready to go play a period. I don't care how tired or hurt I was. Like that shit's fucking insane. But you know, again, I was, you know, I got close with Drew Stafford, you know, years ago. And, you know, it's always good to meet like other guys. And it's so funny because Drew Stafford and I would always talk about like, hey, like, let me tell you about like all these guys that I know in the metal world. And he'd be like, oh, well, there's the same stories about all these guys in the hockey world. And we'd exchange stories like about like, you know, the shit, you know, the greasy shit, you know, that like you shouldn't know. But we would tell each other these secrets and stuff. And it was like, it was really interesting to hear about like all your favorite hockey players, you know, like the weird shit they did in, you know, behind the scenes.
Now, is Drew Stafford a hockey fan? I mean, a metal fan?
Loves fucking Chimera. Loves Chimera like no other. Likes Unearthed, likes all the bands that we like. Stafford's like a real hometown motherfucker. Like he's just like one of your dudes that like just, you know, you would have grown up with. He actually played, I think his like claim to fame was that he played on a line with Crosby when they were on the up and up. I don't know if they were at Michigan together or they might have played the World Juniors together or even like, you know, for Team USA. I'm sorry, Team Canada. But either way, he grew up in Edmonton as like a, you know, I think one of his family members worked for the Oilers in the organization, and he just like worked his way up, played Michigan hockey. What a fucking like rounded great guy, like such a great guy, huge metalhead.
Yeah, he was in the Every Time I Die video decaying with the boys. He was in the background playing Jenga.
Yeah. And yeah, he plays guitar. He came to my studio once and we recorded a track together.
Ritz, that's wild. Sick. Is he playing in a band right now or is he just doing like his own shit?
He's probably just straight up fucking rich from hockey. Probably like, you know, doing some type of fucking like fitness shit, like, you know what I mean, to training people or some shit. But I'm sure he's still ripping guitar. I haven't talked to him in years, but he's just such a fucking great guy. I can't say enough good shit about him. He's a great guy.
Now, when you guys were on Metal Blade, I'm assuming it came up that like Brian is a huge hockey fan as well, right?
He like straight up like, I would tell him all the time about like hockey and shit, about like my career and whatever. And he like looked me up and was like, oh dude, you really were a player. He's like, you know, he found my shit back then. So we've always had like a mutual respect for the sport. And there's a lot of times like we'll catch a Ducks game when we're in Anaheim for NAM and stuff. But like Slagle obviously knows all types of motherfuckers in the league and shit. And like Slagle's a real hockey nut. I mean, I think he has like every jersey ever.
Dude, it's so funny. I went to UBS Arena for the first time over Christmas break, and I'm sitting in the stands before the game starts, and then all of a sudden on the Jumbotron is Brian. And I'm like, and like he's very recognizable. Yeah. I'm like, what the hell? And it goes into this whole story about how one of the Islanders in the late 80s recorded a metal record on Metal Blade Records.
That's so cool.
It was like the coolest crossover story ever. And I'm like, what the heck? I never heard this story at all. And he's like, it's kind of like a short mini documentary. He's talking about this whole, like how it came to be.
Yeah.
And, you know, he's obviously like the guy that kind of discovered Metallica and like,
yeah,
or at least like put out some of their earliest releases. And to hear.
Boo.
Oh, we just lost him.
I'll finish the story. Slagle's fucking Slagle is like one of the nicest guys, and he knows everything about hockey, everything about metal. Such a connoisseur of all things that are nice. But you could talk for hours with him on hockey.
Yeah.
I don't know what just happened.
We never lose right you.
Yeah, but I'm here. Sorry about that. Professional podcast over here.
I have a fun fact about Stafford. He was in a band with Jordan Parisi.
Okay.
Back when they were in the University of North Dakota together. It was called Red Seal Peach, and Parisi was playing drums, I think.
Yeah, dude, fucking Stafford could rip. He plays guitar. He's good. He plays guitar and drums really well. Yeah.
I pulled up that little fun fact on Wikipedia. I was like, that's pretty fucking cool.
He came over my folks' house, like, and my mother made him fucking bunch of like eggplant and lasagna and shit, and he was just like, this is the shit. Like, he's Italian food. He's, yeah, dude, like, we had a real fucking brodeo with him. Like, my sister named her kid Drew because he was just around the time she was pregnant, and they were like, oh, that's a cool name.
It is like the name.
Yeah. Yeah. Fucking A, man.
That's Drew so Stafford. Awesome.
I got to buy his rookie card.
He'll just give you one.
By the way, I'm that guy in the locker room when I play. Like, I'm just like, you know. There was this dude on my team that, like, you know, I had this like one like really good team that kind of broke up, and we like all kind of migrated to another team, and I squeaked one guy in under the radar, and he's like one of those guys who's like might not be like the most like graceful player, but he's like just that grinds constantly, and I would always just like chirp over his shoulder, brag to the dudes on the bench like, he's my pick. I'm the fucking GM. I'm the reason why he's out there. And then I would always be like, I'd always like after the game, I'd be like, we're still in the playoffs, boys. I got this motherfucker's rookie card. You know, I just like straight up like all year. I'm not riding him. I'm just like praising him. He ended up winning us the champion. We just won our men's league championship, and he scored with 1 second left. And I was like, jeez. I feel so accomplished as a GM. I'm that guy in the locker room.
So I know we're kind of like we're creeping up on the hour, but I already told Mikey I was going to go over this. So as I lay dying, how did you come into playing with them? I know like HIPAA had left, but like, what's the story behind that? Like, how did you just link up with them and start ripping shows with them?
Well, I've actually met Tim like years ago. Like, yeah, in Long Island or some shit. Like, I met him, like, back before they were on Pluto, or they were just recording for Pluto. So I've had a long history with Tim, and he's always been a sweet guy. Mm-hmm. I will be the first one to say, like, I'll put this out there up front. Like, when the shit happened with what he, you know, did in his life, and I don't condone anything he ever did, and, like, I don't support it at all. But I can tell you he was a very different person during that time period. Like mm-hmm. I met up with him and they played the Palladium. And I remember like going on the bus and saying hi to all my buds. And I went in the bus to say hi to Tim, and he was like a different person than I ever known him to be. So yeah. I don't know if there was substance or whatever. Like, I don't know what was going on with him, but I remember leaving the bus being like, yo, what's up with your singer? Like, Jesus Christ, you know? So, and all that shit happened and whatever, years went by, you know, he and I, you know, he called me like, when he like was getting out of prison and all that shit. And he was just very like, yo, I'm calling everybody, and I'm like, I feel awful about what I did, and I just want to like make amends, or just like, you know, make sure that we're still friends. And I just kind of got to that point where like in my life where like I could hold grudges against everybody. I know a lot of bad people, and I know a lot of good people, but it depends on how bad of the thing that you did. Like, what he did is it's awful. It's unforgivable to a certain degree. But then again, in my head, I was like, no one got hurt. He did a serious amount of time.
Yeah. He did 6 years.
He did 6 years, and it wasn't like six easy years. And I kind of said to him, listen, dude, like, we've been friends for such a long time. I'm going to like give you the benefit of the doubt and say like, you're fully, you know, recovered from this, and, you know, you've done your time. And I just said something along the lines of like, you need to walk this earth like as a saint for the rest of your life, and as long as you do, you and I will always be cool. I said, until you cross me, or if anything like that ever happens again, like, I can't support you at all, kind of thing. Yeah. And he hasn't disappointed me since. And Unearth did a tour with As I Lay Dying in Europe, and you know, there was definitely friction in the Unearth camp, as far as like, should we do this? Shouldn't we do this? Morally, is it right? How are other people going to perceive us? You know, like, there was a lot of that kind of talk. And my kind of point of view of that whole thing was like, we're here to play music. They're a great band. We've known them forever. Let's just fucking like go out on tour and have a good time and see what happens, you know? And, the tour was great. They were playing in front of fucking 7,000 people a night. Like, shows were insane. There was definitely friction in the band. You could totally tell there was like things happening. The funny thing about As I Lay Dying that people don't understand is that like, the reason why like people are leaving or left the band or things happen, it's not because of what Tim necessarily did per se. I know that's a part of it, but it was definitely like there's five very unique guys in that band.
Yeah.
And they were all very, very different people. And a lot of people don't understand that about that band because like Nick Hippa, very eccentric, super happy and fun, has his like, you know, has his way about him. Jordan, Phil, Tim, they're all very, Josh, they're very unique people. And putting them together is sometimes toxic and sometimes it's really magical. So I was seeing a lot of that on tour and like,
yeah,
it was really funny because there was one sound check where like I grabbed a guitar and they were teaching me a song. Nick was. And if you look back on my Instagram post, it was like funny because someone else from like the drum riser took a picture down at me and like Hippa, like learning a riff. And then like sent it to me. And then I wrote on my Instagram, like trade alert, Nick Hippa from Azalea Dying gets traded to Unearth for Ken Susie in a first round draft pick. Like it was just like years before I knew he was going to leave or anything. Yeah. It was just like kind of a comical joke, but it ended up like coming true. It kind of came true, but like in the moment, you know, right after that tour, Phil kind of hit me up. Phil hit me up and said, like, I think Nick's parting ways. Like, I think he's leaving. It's just like, it's not working out. And I think he wants out. He has, you know, like things are happening. Right.
Yeah.
And he just said to me, like, we want either you or you and Buzz to come out on tour with us and split the set or whatever. They were just like, we just want to kind of like tour with some friends and like, you know what I mean? Enjoy ourselves and pick some guitar players that we like to hang out with more so than just even play with. So I was like, very much like, yeah, dude, like I'm down to play. Like, I would like to tour with you guys and see how it goes and just have fun. And that was in 2019. And then like time flies by, the pandemic sets in, like this whole, like Phil and I just kept talking, you know, just in general, like, hey, should I learn songs? Maybe not. Like, they are looking for a permanent guitar player, all this other shit. And then like the pandemic happened. There was some issues with my band that like, I don't want to get into.
Yeah.
As far as like creatively, philosophically, like everything. And like, there was a lot of like stuff and a lot of it was pointed like towards me and my perspective of like what I think the band should be and what we should do and where we came from and how we used to do it and making decisions based off of like what we believe is right. And some guys are just like, let's play wherever there's electricity. Let's just fucking go. And, you know, and that's cool. But like, I'm also not 20 anymore. And yeah. I also want to retain like the specialness of the band. So you see a lot of bands that go away and then they come back and people miss it and all that shit. And like there was a lot of philosophical differences that were happening. But then there was like some really like stuff that just happened that shouldn't have happened. And it could have been avoided if there was good communication, but ultimately it like resulted in me literally writing a letter saying, guys, I'm sorry, I can't do this anymore. Mm-hmm. And it like, I was hurt. And like, there's things that like went down. But when I say I was hurt, it's okay. Because like, sometimes you just don't agree on things.
Yeah.
And I'm hurt because it's a band I started and I put so much effort into it. But ultimately, like, I had to also let it go because it was like, I can't be the guy always saying no to things and all that kind of stuff. And I just didn't want to be that guy in the band and say, guys, like, I don't think that's the right thing. And everyone's like, no, this is the right thing. And I can't convince four guys out of five that what I'm saying is right and what I believe to be right. I think I'm just now the square peg that can't fit in the round hole. Right. Mm-hmm. So I just said, like, listen, I just want to like leave. I just want to like step away and do my own thing. And I like literally like when everything resurfaced, like Phil and I were talking and like it turned into like I was still supposed to fill in for them. That never stopped from 2019.
Yeah.
So Phil was hitting me up and he's just like, hey, do you still want to play? And I'm like, I actually don't have a band anymore. And yeah, sure. Cause like I don't have anything else going on. It would be great to like play with you guys. And like, in my head, I was like, it would be a great field trip to like, you know, just do something else, be somewhere else.
Yeah.
Like sometimes you're just so in your own circle and smelling your own shit and your perspective of like your band in the scene and how everything is and how people perceive you was such like a integrated in my head as a guy in the band. But like having gotten out of the band and playing for somebody else, it was such a nice little field trip to like walk in somebody else's shoes and do some other shit, you mm-hmm. know? But one thing that I was very like adamant about was I didn't leave Unearth for, you know, financial reasons. I didn't join Azalea Dying or anything full time. And I didn't like want to play with them for financial reasons. It wasn't like it was a payday or anything crazy. I do fine in my life.
Yeah.
I just wanted to play music with some people that like I really like genuinely love, and they're good guys, and I've known them for such a long time, and it worked, and it just worked out. I never left Unearthed because there was an opportunity in front of me. It was never anything like that. It was more so like, we're not vibing. I need to just go like do something else. It's like, yeah, like after
go on a vacation for a little bit.
That's exactly like a musical journey, vacation, whatever you want to call it. But ultimately, I did some fucking shows with Nick was a part of the Nick Pierce, the drummer, was a part of like everything that was kind of happening as it was happening in parallel. And there was some things that were like kind of put on his shoulders that also were like, he agreed with a lot of the things I was saying, but he and I weren't talking. So it was very weird because like, I wasn't talking to him. He wasn't talking to me. I was very like distant from the band, yet he was agreeing with me, but not really articulating it with me or calling me.
Yeah.
So ultimately, like after a week after I like kind of resigned, he also sent a letter to everybody resigning as well and called me and was like, and we had a long conversation and he's like, yeah, I just don't want to do it anymore. And he's like, you know, I love the guys and everything, but I can't do it like this anymore. I can't do this. And I said, dude, totally understandable. And then like, sure enough, like here I am as this guitar player supposed to play for As They Lay Dying, thinking it's going to be Phil, Tim, Josh, Jordan, and myself playing on some shows. Turned out to be like Josh left for Spirit Box. Jordan has been MIA for a while. We need a drummer and a bass player. And it's just me, Phil, and Tim. And I'm like, whoa, this is fucking crazy. And Nick. I'm like, is this bad? You know? And then I was just like, yo, Nick's out of Unearthed. You might want to call him, but I didn't really like put two and two together. I just kind of had a conversation with Phil.
Before
he disclosed that Jordan was like not around, I also said to Phil, like, wow, man, like Nick left Unearthed. Like it's crazy. And then Phil and Nick started talking, you know what I mean? And like, you know, it all kind of came together. But to be honest with you, when it came to like actually playing for those guys, the first phone call I made was to Unearthed to tell them, like at the time I was still in the band and I was like, I think this would like land us a good tour with them in the future to help our new record. That was my first intent. Everybody knew I was going to do it. But then like after the fact, it was like, my second thing was like, I have to call Nick Hippa because Nick Hippa is like one of my closest friends, you know, I consider him a close friend and I wanted him to hear this from me before he heard it from anywhere else.
Yeah.
I hold his friendships in such high regard that I didn't want to like not call him. And I think like when I did call him, he said it best. He's like, I'm so glad you called me and you like, we talked before you like made any decisions or did anything because he goes, you know, I don't think you know, he's like, I'm not going to tell you to do it or not do it, but he's just like, here are the things that you might, endure if you join or if you play with them.
Yeah.
And he's like, I'm just looking out for you as a friend. And we had a really good talk and Nick's like supportive and we hang out and I got really lucky, you know. Like with this gig the gig's been really good so far.
It just blows my mind how, a guitarist from the North Shore, like lines up with a band from San Diego, California. It's like complete opposite sides of the coast. It's just a really cool, story just of all of it coming together. And especially with, you know, everything that Tim went through and everything that you guys have gone through, it's just like, I don't know. It's like my 2002 to 2006 worlds colliding with everything.
Well, West Coast guys are very different than East Coast guys.
Yeah.
we have a certain type of like way about us, a bluntness and or like a swagger, and the West Coast guys don't have that. So there is sometimes where like we're writing or things are happening and like they're just like, it's too Massachusetts for us, you know? And like, and I'll be like, okay, whatever. Like, you know, I don't know what that means, but that's cool. but no, ultimately it works because one of the things that I do like about As They Lay Dying is that like business-wise that we align with like our, like how to do things from point A to point B, like seeing the tour through, how to prepare for a tour, how to like, you know, how to set up a set list, how to do a live show. Me, Tim, and Phil definitely align on how like the professionalism should be. Whereas like with Unearthed, like I would say they're more so like you know, we want to just like throw our gear up on stage and play.
Yeah.
Which is totally a way to do it. And it's awesome for me. Like I want to do big stuff. I've always, even in Unearth, I always used to like blow foghorns on stage and try to do things that would like incite the audience to remember you. And, Azalea Dying does take, like, they take a great amount of like detail into consideration when they make decisions, and they're very, very like communicative. Like they talk really well. We communicate very well. Like we get on a phone call and we all talk. So that's actually really, really good. And they're like appreciative of it too, because some of the members that have left, they're like, you know, we could never get on a phone call and talk. And I would always be like, well, I could never get on a phone call and talk. And now that we're all like, you know, like communicating well, and we all kind of have the same vibe of how to run a business and play in a band, things go together pretty easily.
Yeah.
Now you mentioned, you know, writing with these guys for the first time. And from my understanding, you have some new As I Lay Dying tunes that you guys have been working on. So how has that been going for you?
Well, like, how do I explain it? Like I was put into a position where like, I'm not a member of the band, and I never really aspired to be like a member of the band. It's kind of cool though, that now that I've toured with them and I could see myself like, you know, playing with them full time or just touring member full time. But like, I didn't expect them to ask me to like help. Right. Like, you know, it's all well and good. It's like Tim and Phil like write the majority of the material. And I know Josh wrote a lot of the material. So like, they're like the type of band that like, they do their thing so well that I don't think they would need my help. So when they did extend themselves out and ask and say, hey, like, we really want you to be a part of this, it was actually a nice gesture. And I've been doing my best to like help them in every way, like along the way to insert myself. Like I've been really good about like, you know, here are these songs and inserting my notes and like, here's what I would do. And, you know, and like, sometimes I come up with a riff or whatever and like, and help. I'm not like 100% hands-on, but I also like don't have to be, because like, I also don't want to fuck up like what they do, what they currently do. They're such a good band as is. So, I am helping. The new record's coming out really great. Ryan Neff is like one of my favorite people ever. Like the bass player, Miss May I singer, like he's like one of the sweetest guys ever. And he's someone who I always wished to be in a band with, like the way he is. He's just such a great person. And Nick, obviously, I have years of experience with him, and Tim and Phil. It's just, everyone's been really easy to work with. The record's coming out phenomenal. I think people are going to be surprised for sure.
Okay. And nice. Are you flying out to like San Diego for these sessions, or, you know, now with all the like technology that we have, are you able to do it remotely?
I've flown out a couple times. Most of it's been remote. I love the whole San Diego fucking based band thing for many reasons. Like I live in Massachusetts, so it gets fucking cold here. Not that I'm like a puss and I can't handle the cold, but I also love like when I go to rehearse
weather,
right? When I go to rehearse with them, I'm on a beach, you know, on the ocean, like super chill. And San Diego is a beautiful fucking place. So that helps. And like, one of the best things in the world is that like, when you go on tour, and a lot of people like don't know this, but like, usually when I was on tour with Unearth, like a van or a bus would pick us up in the early days, a bus would pick us up and would start in Massachusetts, go around the country, come home and finish somewhere near Massachusetts and have to drive home with the bus. Being in a San Diego based band is unbelievable. Because I fly to San Diego, we rehearse, we go, we play half the country, and I'm home like 2 weeks, and I'm home, and I get like a day or two home, and then we like do the rest of the tour, and then I fly from wherever we are back to home. It's like the best situation for me, because there's no like bullshit with travel for me.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Touche. So I guess, Ken, before we let you leave, you know, we are right in the middle of the playoffs, and I know that you probably want to catch the end of the Bruins game if it hasn't ended yet.
I think they're losing.
Look, we jinxed you guys. Oh my god,
we jinxed it.
No, if they tied it, Bruins tied it in the third. Fuck yeah, Bergeron.
Yeah, there's what, 11 minutes left?
Oh god. Bruins just like, okay, like I'm just gonna answer your fucking question without you even asking it. Bruins are gonna fuck if the I'm not gonna be one of those fans that's like Bruins are gonna fucking win, bro. I'm just gonna say if the Bruins pull this off this year, they are one of those deep, dark, heavy fucking teams that like you might have seen from Tampa from years ago, like just like wear you down, big boy fucking hockey shit. And like I'm not just saying this because of the year that they have. They just they Don Sweeney made so many good moves with like Foligno, Ovalev or whatever from fucking the Capitals, Bertuzzi, like all these dudes, like Coyle starting to really develop, Pasternak, the first line's kicking, Ullmark's like if this team pulls it off, it's the great it might be the greatest team of all time assembled for one season. I will never say like, you know, they're the greatest team of all time because like, you know, we all know that like the Edmonton Oilers of the 80s, you know what I mean? Like, you know, I can't disrespect, you know, the Canadian teams of the 70s and the 60s, but I will say like single season wise, if they win the cup this year, it's like arguably the greatest team of all time, like in a single season.
And they'll be the third team in recent history if they make it to the cup and win the cup and the President's Trophy in the same season. Cause I think the only other team in teams in modern history have been like the Red Wings and the Blackhawks.
Right. And the tough part, the tough part is that like, let's not forget, like when the Bruins won the cup in 11, like we literally like beat the President's Trophy team. I mean, we beat the Canucks. They were the best team in the league. So like that's makes me nervous too as well. But the thing I have confidence in, like if the Bruins can make it through the East, I think they can easily win the cup.
Yeah.
I think any team that
we've been saying that this entire season, any team from the East, if they go to the Stanley Cup, they're taking the Stanley Cup.
So my take is this, and I don't mean to be like one of those guys, but like I know hockey and like the Kings are shot. Like the Oilers are like have great talent, but their fucking defense in the middle of the ice is just always open for, you know, like Drezdel, whatever his name is, and Connor McDavid, it's all well and good. But if you don't have defense, real defense, or the middle of the ice isn't clogged up with fucking big oafy fucking dudes that can lay body, like you're not going to win a cup that way. And like Avalanche are struggling with the fucking Seattle, which is bullshit. And like, you know, Dallas looks pretty good too. Like they might be one of those teams that makes it pretty deep. But like the fucking, I just could say the East right now, God damn it. Like the Rangers, I think are the second best team in the East, even though they're like a low seed because of Kane. They're just like a hard ass team, and they're giving fucking the Devils a real run, which is a great team. And then you got like the Canes are sick and the Bruins, and then like the Leafs will choke. We all know that, but goddamn, they're like them and Tampa are really battling too.
It's been a great series, the Tampa Leafs series, and I've been really pissed about it just because it's had me on the edge of my seat for the last three games. But
yeah, I want to see the Leafs win. I want to see them play Bruins and Bruins sweep them in four. It would be just such an ignorant fucking like Leafs fans would just hang themselves. I would if I was a Leafs fan. Let me tell you my missed opportunity since we're talking hockey, please. In 2010 and 2009. Okay, so let me go back a little further. I'm so sorry. I know
no, you're good. You're good. Here,
but I'm just so excited about this conversation. I was such a fucking,
let him run.
Okay, from birth to like 97, I was such a Bruins fan. Like I would watch every fucking game with my father. I'd study everything. Ray Bourque was an idol, lived in my town, went to his front door with a piece of paper as a little kid. And I said, can I have your autograph? And he's like, yeah, hold on a second. He takes the piece of paper from my hand, goes to the basement, grabs an autograph fucking photo of himself, signs it in front of me, hands it to me. I went to his door randomly. Ray Bourque, fucking greatest guy in the world. Anyway, I was huge Bruins fan, right? And then like Cam Neely, you know, Adam Oates, like all these fucking great hockey players growing up. Like I was, you know, they should have won the cup in the 80s. Oilers took it from us, whatever. When Cam Neely, when Ulf Samuelsson fucking hit Cam Neely and hurt his knee, that I stopped watching hockey from 97 to like 2003. I couldn't handle how bad the Bruins, they became a bunch of fucking pussies. And the coach was a piece of shit. Like they ousted Chris Nyland off the team because they wanted to be a bunch of losers. And they were such a bad fucking hockey team that I didn't pick up until like 2003. when like the Panthers were really good. I think it was the Panthers. And like, you know, I just started getting back into the Bruins. And like then, like, because my heart was broken. I could never recover from the Neely thing. And it changed the course of history. But anyway, I was like, I had a hookup with the Garden. And there was this girl, Brianna, who like used to fucking hook me up. And like, I used to go to all these games. I used to take Adam D all the time. We sat in the Esplanade up in the top. And like in 2010, I remember we lost in the playoffs to the Flyers. And I was like, God damn it. The Bruins shouldn't won, but you could tell they should have won. But Bergeron, you could tell they're all fucked up, like injuries and shit. They just didn't put it together. I was there for that game that they got ousted from the playoffs. And I remember saying that summer, I was like, I think the Bruins are going to go to the Cup. I should buy season tickets. This is the year. And I was like this close. And at the last minute, I fucking chickened out. I even had a clear open touring schedule. I didn't have anything to do in 2011. I was just like, this is such a great time to do it. And I didn't fucking do it. And the Bruins fucking went to win the Cup. And I'm a fucking asshole because of it. So there you go. That's my story.
So are you a huge Johnny Boychuk fan?
Boychuk wasn't like, he wasn't my dude. Boychuk wasn't my dude. Like I was into like, are you talking like modern day Bruins that were just hard as fuck?
Yeah.
Like that 2011 team, like, I mean, Lucic was a fucking, he was like the Gronkowski, like, you know, football terms of like hockey players at the time. And the Bruins used him up and traded him at the right time because you can only take so much abuse in the league until you start really slowing down. And they traded Lucic at the right time. But he was a fucking monster. Having him, Thornton, Horton on the same line. That line was like, you go to the games and you're like, fucking Chara, Lucic, Horton, fuck it. They were big boys, like real big boys.
Yep.
So I was way into that kind of shit. And I was into Ryder was like one of my favorite guys. He was a guy who actually glove hand saved one of the fucking pucks in the net, like in the playoffs and saved, like pretty much won us a series doing that. And Thornton, Tim Thomas, like that, those guys were real core. But you know, Bergeron, Marchand, like all those guys. I liked McQuaid better than I like homeboy who you just mentioned.
Boychuk.
Yeah. McQuaid like had more heart on the blue line, I would say. But man, there's some really fucking, those are some really great teams. Like we've been blessed with sports in Boston in the 2000s, basically, like with Patriots and the Celtics and everything. So like, I got to the point in my life where I'm like, I've seen all the championships so much, and you never get sick of winning, but like at one point you like watch these guys win and you're like, God damn it. Like I didn't win anything, you know? So like, why am I so excited? You know, like we won, but like this me being spoiled.
Yeah.
That is 100% you being spoiled because I'm going to feel like I won the championship when the Islanders win the championship. Like that is 100% how I'm going to feel.
The last time I got up and actually fucking Ray Bourque fist pumped at a game was when Brady and the Patriots beat the fucking Falcons. They came back and beat the Falcons.
Oh, that was such a good game too.
Cause I swear to God, they were so close. And I remember saying there was like barely any time left, but I'm like, they could fucking win. Like, I'm like, I think they're going to win. This is fucking crazy. And then when shit went down, I was literally losing my mind, fist pumping, like, fuck you, yelling at the TV. Like, I'm not like that, but I was definitely like that when the Bruins, like when Bergeron scored that goal game 7 against the Canucks. And like, he like dove into the net. Like he was just like, I think he scored it with his helmet, not even his fucking stick. That was like another moment where I was like, we're going to win the fucking cup. I was like, I was out of my fucking mind. I couldn't believe it.
I can't wait for that feeling. One day. And
that game 7 led to my favorite moment in news history. The Vancouver riots. The second time. And the guy getting hit right in the Charlie Browns with a flashbang. Yeah. And the flashbang bouncing off and then exploding like within inches of all of that. Yeah. Oh man. I watched that clip on repeat on YouTube for so long.
I just knew we were going to win because if you actually like go back and watch some footage of Roberto Longo, whatever his name is, right?
Yep.
His eyes are always like this, never blinks. He looks like he's always nervous. Yeah. And he was letting in some fucking shot goals in the cup. Like, if I was a Canucks fan, I would have lost my mind. I would have hung myself.
Some of them probably did.
Yeah. So that Bruins team, God bless them. Oh, God damn. It was such a good moment. Like, to be honest with you, seeing the Red Sox win, there was like people that died that like it's been 100 years since they won the World Series and shit and like whatever. And the Patriots were always like great. But like, especially for me, always seeing like that great, the greatest goal in hockey, but you know, Bobby Orr on repeat all the time growing up as a kid, seeing that magical goal. I just never thought in my lifetime I'd see the Bruins win a cup. And I can honestly say I could die happy, like having seen a cup like one in it hoisted in Boston. It was just so fucking special.
Touche. It's true. I'm kind of in the same boat. You know, I was too young for the Islanders dynasty. I wasn't born yet. So the furthest we've gotten is the last couple of years when we made it to the Eastern Conference Finals, and that's like it in my lifetime. And that was already special. So
yeah.
Going even further is
Mike Bossy was a real motherfucker. Mike Bossy's like, he's one of those guys. And like, since you're an Islanders guy, he's one of those guys growing up as a kid that I would watch like footage of and like try to like figure out what his deal was. Patty LaFontaine.
Yep.
He's one of those guys that I would like, since I'm shorter, I used to study his play more than any other hockey player out there. If there was a guy who I wanted to be, which I'm definitely not, like I'm not a skilled player like him. Just his positioning, where he would always be and all that shit was like one of those, like he was always that guy who's always there. He's always open, like a Gretzky. Like, I don't know why there wasn't a body on him, but somehow he'd be a ghost until he wasn't. And one of the greatest hockey players of all time was an Islander, and that's Mike Bossy and Patty LaFontaine.
Hell yeah. And it's so funny. The last episode we were talking about when the Islanders and Bruins played each other not too long ago in the playoffs and how they kept bringing up how one of the Bruins was like from Long Island. Like all the national commentators kept bringing that up at every single game.
Right.
And I couldn't remember who it was. And then it just came to me like right now. It was like, oh, that was Charlie McAvoy. Like that's the dude that's from Long Island.
Yeah. Yeah, McAvoy is a real motherfucker too. Like he's a great defenseman, like real quiet, but like he just makes such an impact. He's Ray Bourque was like that too. Not like really like a outgoing, like Ray Bourque always just had a knack for scoring like every fucking, shift. I don't know how he fucking did it. His shot was just so precise. His forearms were like the size of my bicep. It's insane. Like seeing that guy in real life. As a kid, you look at him and you're like, Jesus Christ, I'm looking at Paul Bunyan, but he wasn't the biggest guy, but you just don't like think about Ray Bourque as like being this like super impactful player where he super stands out, you know? But he was, and same thing with McAvoy. Like you just don't think of him as like this top tier D, but when he's out there, it matters.
Just yeah. Eating those important minutes, right? That's kind of what you want from your defenseman really is just being able to eat 26, 27 minutes a game.
Yeah. And to be honest with you, in the early days, like 2009, 2008 or whatever, I hated Chara. I was like, who is this fucking loser? He would be on the ice and it just seems like his stick was too big and the puck would always jump over his stick. And like, he was always making mistakes and shit. But like, man, like he really came into his own around 2009, 2010, like and on. He just like, I mean, Christ, I think he almost killed a motherfucker in Montreal when he hit him into the boards on that weird play. God damn, he's a fucking beast.
And just ran the Boston Marathon, I saw.
Yeah,
he actually runs marathons and he does like, I always wondered why like people don't fuck with him enough. Cause I know he's a big guy, but I would think more dudes would fuck with him. But I found out that he's like this weird, like martial arts, like tough guy. Like I know some people in town and they were just like, yeah, he's a real deal fighter. Like he could fight for real. And like dudes wouldn't fuck around with him because they actually knew he had some like real shit going on.
Well, he's also like 7'3" with skates on.
It doesn't matter though. Like you could like, to be honest with you, like when I fought and I did shit and like hockey and whatever, they make you take boxing and I'm only 5'7", you know, but like I can fight easily against bigger guys than smaller guys. Like it's the Mike Tyson thing. You get inside on somebody big, he can't swing at you because you're inside and you're throwing. Yeah. But Char was that tough. I think dudes wouldn't fuck with him.
Can we, so this, I'm just going to go over this fun fact about that whole Chara Pacioretty hit. He literally pushed Pacioretty's head into an off ice stanchion at the end of the bench.
Yeah.
Fractured his fourth vertebrae, put him in a severe concussion. They had to pull him off the ice on a stretcher. Mike Murphy, who was president of operations at the time, said, "Ah, it's just a hockey play." The Montreal police launched a criminal investigation against Chara.
Yeah, the second game, they were like, they're going to arrest him.
Yeah, and then they were like, oh, he's not going to be criminally charged. But then he was the reason, that hit was the reason why the NHL mandated all curved glass at the end of benches.
Go back and watch that hit. I'll say this. Like, I've seen some fucking hits in my day, like in the NHL. I'll say that was one of the worst, like meaning it's clean, but like it was unfortunate. Sometimes yeah. Sometimes you get caught up and you're in the wrong spot and it's very, very unfortunate. But like, as far as like pure body to body hit, that's a real big one. And like anything from Scott Stevens, like that guy had a knack for lining dudes up the right way and cleanly. And like Char and him probably delivered some of the biggest hits I've ever seen on the ice.
Dude, his head literally hit the ball.
I know all the shit's curved now, but back then it was like a post and his ass rode that bench. And like, dude, I knew that guy,
his body kept going.
Yeah. I thought that guy was going to be fucking dead. 100%. You know, it's kind of crazy too. Like shit. Like you see that kind of shit on like, you know, playbacks and stuff like that. Like, I didn't know. I think I'm sure you guys know this, but like, you know, that goalie from the Sabres who got his like throat cut.
Yeah.
And you see the video where he like holds his throat and all the blood keeps coming out. I never knew that happened. And it's so funny. You guys were talking about like Mike's Brian Slagle and all that stuff.
Yeah.
And Brian Slagle, like one night, I swear to God, I watched that. I was like looking up hockey shit and like, and I saw that play too. And I didn't know that happened. And I literally picked up the phone the second I saw the video and I called Brian Slagle. I was like, "Yo, did you know this happened?" And he's like, "Yeah." And he told me the whole story. He was like, "Yeah." And he knew the backstory. He's like, they stitched him up. He's now the assistant coach of the fucking goalies and blah, blah, blah.
Yeah.
And he put my mind at ease because I wasn't going to be able to sleep that night. I had to call Slagle to ask him if that guy died.
Dude, that was an insane just accident that happened. And actually, it happened to Cam Neely, not the face, but he got like the top of his pinky cut off through his glove,
right,
in the 90s too.
Right. The 90s was a different type of hockey.
Yeah.
Dudes were really fucking crazy. Probert. Yeah. Like there's some real brain dead fighters coming out of the 90s hockey. Like Jay Miller versus like Nylund, Probert versus Nylund, Probert versus like, it's just Probert versus anybody. That guy was a fucking machine. He was the Ivan Drago of hockey. We traded for, I'll never forget it, 92. I went to a playoff game, Bruins Canadians, and we had Al McGinnis. No, not Al McGinnis. Al Iafredi, the guy with the mullet, but a bald head. And he used to smoke butts and drive Harleys to the fucking game. And they traded him right after that season because no one could deal with him fucking ripping butts in between periods. But he had his slap shot. I'll say this, as a kid, it being in the stands, his slap shot was so hard that like when it hit like the goalie's pads, you could hear it all over the rink. It was insane.
Yeah.
Look up Al Iafredi's slappers.
We talk about it on the podcast how like mid 90s was probably like the heyday of hockey. I think like that's when it was just like in pop culture. And some of the names that were like dominating the league were, you know, you had your Gretzky's, your Lemieux's, your Jagers, but then you also had characters like that still in the league.
Dude, it was Pavel Bure, fucking all the Red Wings.
Yeah.
Yeah. Fedorov, Hasek, and Andy Moog might have still been playing, Fuhrer. Brodeur. What was the Rangers goalie at the time? Richter?
Richter, yeah. Richter.
It was just like a locked up fucking 90s hockey was like, God damn, and fights like everywhere.
That, yeah, it was a different game. And I don't know if hockey's ever going to get back to that. I just...
Timu Solani.
Oh, yeah.
God.
Paul Kariya,
Coffey. Like, you got some real fucking Iron Men playing fucking a man's game back then. Like, the thing that I don't like about hockey now is that there's too much, like, system. Like kids grow up and they play a system and they're good at the system and then they get into the NHL and they continue to play the system. Where like Gretzky almost said, I heard an interview where Gretzky said it and he's like, yeah, but like we used to be more improv like on the ice. And that's one thing that is like kind of missing from hockey. We do need like kind of like a Happy Gilmore to come back and like do some shit. And I think Ovechkin's kind of that way where he just kind of like does his thing and he fucking does what he can. Yeah. And I like that about him. That's why I like both Kachucks. I like those guys because you could tell they're just like bred for hockey. It's not necessarily about the system. It's about how they play the game. There's a lot of passion in there. So there are some guys, but you could totally tell which guys are those guys. But everybody else is just like a fucking like, you know, like when you play table hockey. Yeah, it's like, cool. This is the line he goes in, and this is where he's going to be. And then
he's going to dump the puck and dump and chase.
But Lemieux used to fucking dress dudes down, like big time, like get into the net, like make some moves, like things would happen, you know, whatever. Miraculous shit. But
amen. Well, Ken, we got a overtime game. It's 3-3 heading to overtime. Bruins.
Marchand's going to score.
Looking to lock it down. Now, truthfully, though, you guys are going to be possibly the first ones to punch your ticket. Not necessarily a great thing. Not necessarily. Yes, you can rest some people, but if you have to go against a team that maybe grinds it out to 6 or 7 games, sometimes they can continue to ride that, and you guys are sitting kind of the complacent waiting for that team to, you know, figure out who you're playing.
Yeah. Not in the position that the Bruins are in. If you think philosophically, yes. In actuality, they went full throttle to the end of the season. So Bergeron's a little dinged up, like tired, you know, they sat him for the first like 3 games or whatever. I think the Bruins could really use a quick out in the first round so they can just like reflect, come back, and like let the fucking Leafs and the Tampa beat the shit out of themselves. They're not going to, neither one of those teams is going to be hockey ready for the second round, where the Bruins will be, because they're just like mentally there. I think the Bruins are like first round quick, you know, would be a good thing.
Okay. So
yeah,
hopefully it happens in overtime tonight and then you guys can rest up and hopefully take care of the Leafs as everyone around the world would like to see happen. Except Toronto.
Well, except Tampa too. I'd rather have Tampa take out the Leafs.
as long as someone takes them out.
Yeah.
I'm going to say Bruins 2 overtimes. Marchand scores to win it tonight.
Okay. You're going to hear it first on Bar Down Breakdown. I love that.
Hear it first on Tuesday after the game.
Yeah.
Hey, I'll clip it up and be like, yep, Ken said it.
And I'll also say this: fuck Mitzi and the Rangers.
we gotta clip that one.
Also clipping that up and sending that to Mitz.
make that the Instagram like, oh, okay, we had Kitsisi on the podcast. It's just fuck Mitz and the Rangers. God, I love Mitzi so bad. He's seriously my favorite person in the world.
Amen. Yeah,
when he brought up the opportunity of you entertaining the idea of coming on, I was just like doe-eyed. I was like, let's go.
Yeah. I actually hit him up because I listened and I was just like, Mitz, like these dudes are doing the right thing. Like, let them know I'm in. If they want to fucking party, I'm in. Like, I'll talk about hockey all fucking night. I'll fucking turn the camera around and show you my slapper, dude. I don't give a shit. Like, that's my whole game. I skate fast, rip slappers. That's my whole fucking shit. My team gets on me because I don't do anything else, but I score a ton. So fuck them.
I love that. I love dudes that just grind it out in men's league hockey and talk shit in men's league hockey. It's the best thing ever.
Yeah, so it's so funny. One of the dudes that's a huge Rangers fan too is like, I posted my team, like we were holding the cup and the stats too, because I thought it'd be cool, like for everybody to see, like, you know, my friends and whatever, their achievements. And someone's like, oh, you have the most points on the team. I bet you didn't fucking like play defense. I'm like, are you shitting me? I'm like, I'm the center. I'm all about back checking and forechecking, motherfucker. Like, I'm not like, if I don't back check, the team doesn't fucking win, you know? I played D in high school, so like, and I played forward in college, and I'm like, I know the importance. So the reason why we have a cup in our men's league is because I'm there to score a goal, but I'm also there to fucking cover the fucking forwards. Fuck off.
Anyway. I'm not gonna lie, I did not back check or forward check when I played men's league hockey. I was not that guy.
If you're in a competitive league, there's nothing more gratifying than like, you know, like your other dudes not back checking and you leading by example and back checking wicked hard. And like, then they're all like, all right, Susie, fucking good job. And I'm like, yeah, do it yourself. If like, if you do it, it becomes like other dudes feel like they have to do it too. That's how you win.
True captain yeah. of your men's league team.
Yeah. I'm not the captain. I don't buy the beer.
You drink it.
Yeah, I'm always just trying to. I'm just trying to get my team to go to fucking centerfolds or pudgies after the game. But all the dudes are fucking married and their wives won't let them go. It's bullshit. I'm like, let's go see some fat girls dance naked, and they're like, no. I'm like, we just won the cup. Like, no. I'm like, fuck off. I'm off this team. I'm trading myself. Listen, you guys are fucking great, man. We if you live in Long Island or whatever, DM me your numbers and shit. I would love to, like, you know, come out to As Lay Dying show. Let's talk more hockey and have a couple fucking drinks and hang out for sure. You guys are great.
I'm down in Orlando, so if you guys have a stop down anywhere in Florida, I would fucking love that.
Yeah, just anytime you know where I'm gonna be, DM me and we're hanging out. Fucking it.
Amen. Well, Ken, dude, let's go Bees. Let's finish this off. And let's fucking wipe out the Maple Leafs.
Yeah. All right, guys. Well, listen, have a good night. Thanks for having me on your show. This is great.
Hell yeah, brother.
Anytime, man.
Peace.
Thanks, guys. Later.